Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Daily Objective. Today I've got Joseph DeBenkin with me. We haven't had Joseph in a while. How's it going, Joseph?
Going well, thanks. How are you?
I'm not too bad, not too bad. It's been a busy day, but I'm glad to be here with you. So today I think we're going to talk about something which is really relevant, really interesting, and really important. Normally it's about a book, but it's about a topic which we've had a lot of people bring up on the channel and a lot of you guys asking about in the comments. And this is surrounding Japan in World War II and its defeat. Particularly the book is Embracing Defeat, which Joseph has read recently and has some really interesting insights into. So Joseph, why don't you just introduce the book for people and just unpack it a bit?
Yeah, so the book's called Embracing Defeat. It's about America's occupation of Japan post-World War II. It talks a little bit about the kind of conditions in which the occupation happened. And it goes into a lot of detail about the nature of that occupation, specifically what America did to reform Japan and its culture.
Fantastic. And the context obviously is with the situation going on in Israel right now and what people are making a lot of comparisons with Japan. And I think this will be useful to get a kind of deeper perspective on that comparison and really make some profit from that. So why don't you explain a little bit for us about how the situation between America and Japan unfolded as it's told in the book?
Yeah, I think I want to take a step back for a moment and just, I think, emphasize why I think this is important to think about and contemplate. Because I think right now there's a lot of, it's somewhat justified cynicism about the war that's going on in Israel or between Israel and Hamas, because a lot of people are going to die, and I don't know if many people have confidence that it's going to result in any sort of lasting peace, and that's a hard pill for many people to swallow if you're generally a benevolent person, right? Civilian casualties are not a good thing. And it's a very different proposition to think about those civilian casualties in the context of a long-term, multi-decade peace versus a conflict that will just happen again and again and again. So I think that's the important backdrop, because when you look at the American situation in Japan post-World War II, it's a very different outcome. The scale of civilian deaths was insane, right? The number of people that died, Japanese civilians alone, was insane. But we've had 70 years of absolute peace with Japan. They're an ally. And just to really make this comparison hit home, I think it's important to realize World War II ended in 1945, right? Israel's independence happened 3 years later. We're talking about almost the same period of time. What's incredible as I started to look into this is America's occupation of Japan started 1945 and ended 7 years later. So we're not talking about decades of occupation to reform this country. We're talking about a period of 7 years. Israel's War of Independence ended in 1949. So we're talking about hostilities ending almost, within 3 years of each other, 4 years of each other. And yet the outcomes have been completely different. America has enjoyed 70 years or so of absolute peace with now an ally. Israel's dealing with a hostile aggressor for that same period of time. So the big kind of backdrop of the question is, what was different about how America handled the situation? Are there any lessons we can learn? And how can we maybe talk about Israel and the Palestinians in the same way that we talk about the Japanese and Americans, right? Wouldn't it be incredible to think about the Palestinians as this peaceful, prosperous ally that's not only not hostile, but actually, an ally, like a partner almost in the world? So that's kind of the context. And I think we can kind of dive into the book and some of those lessons with that backdrop.
For sure. And if the Palestinians get as good as tech as the Japanese, we'll have a whole new revolution in the world, you know? And I think you make a valuable point as well, because certainly talking about the war a lot, as we do on the channel and diving into the news every day, I think I slip a lot into the kind of feeling of despair about it, about the idea of what kind of resolution can we bring to this, which is going to be realistic. And the Japanese comparison is good because it's not just a kind of floating hypothetical. It's a concrete, real situation, as you said, which didn't take decades. So I think this is going to be really interesting. So,
Yeah, that's definitely one thing that really stuck with me is when I saw that 7-year number, right, that America was out within 7 years, and the absolute reversal that had to happen in order for America to leave, it's astounding. It's within a lifetime, right? Within our lifetime, peace is possible. So that's, I think, a really nice way to look at it, an optimistic way to look at it.
For sure. So, okay, then. Well, let's get into some of the meat of it then. So what was the situation in Japan that the Americans brought about? Like, how did they achieve this?
Yeah, so I think what I found really important and seems like a good starting point is America and the Allies had a very clear goal while the war was still going on. And it's nice to think about this, too, for our perspective, because in Israel right now, there is an active war going on. It's not like we're talking about Israel just defeated Hamas and we have to figure out what to do now. No, there's still an active war. So Israel has an opportunity to follow in the Allies' footsteps. And what was clear about the Allied goal, maybe you've heard of like the Potsdam declarations, but I'll read you one quote. The Allies had a very clear goal on what was going to happen when the war ended. First of all, you've probably heard that there was unconditional surrender, right? Unlike World War I, it was clear to the Allies that there needed to be a clear winner and loser, and that the loser was surrendering unconditionally, and that the victors got to impose whatever reality it was they wanted onto the losers. But I'll read you another quote of what was the explicit goal. It was to ensure, and this is a quote, to ensure that that Japan will not again become a menace to the United States or to the peace and security of the world. Now, there's a couple of really important things I want to unpack. The goal is not to indefinitely occupy Japan and make them into a colony of America or into some subservient nation. Part of the goal was understood, I think implicit in that statement, but also I think was made explicit. Japan would be a sovereign nation, assuming that they could demonstrate that they would not again become a menace to the United States. As long as they're not going to be an enemy and disrupt world peace, they can earn their sovereignty. And I think that's a really important way to think about it. When you have this active war going on, when you've got hundreds of thousands of civilians that are going to die in the context of World War II, it's a very different pill to swallow if the context is not that we're going to have this indefinite problem on our hands after, but that we have this goal of a sovereign nation. And I think in particular in the context of the Israeli conflict, just given how things have unfolded over the last 70 years, I think it's a different perspective to if Israel were explicit about its goal. We're going to defeat Hamas, and here's what the world is going to look like afterwards. Maybe, and I'm not saying Israel needs to do this, but whether it's an independent Palestinian state in Gaza or the West Bank, but make a very clear outcome of what it's going to look like. A sovereign Palestinian people that are living peacefully inside or outside of Israel, whatever they decide is most appropriate, that is peaceful and not hostile to Israel's interests. And so I think that's a really important context in which the occupation is going to happen, is there's a clear goal of what victory looks like and what's going to happen after they win the war.
Mm, for sure. And maybe later on, we can comment on if you have any thoughts about Netanyahu's, what he's been signaling in terms of his plan and whether it lines up with what America's plan was like. Daniel just mentions a comment in the chat, which I think might relate to some of the context from the Japanese side as well, because I think that's maybe important just to pin down. So someone mentioned, the difference is the Japanese population was not radicalized under an extremist religion like Gaza. Also, the Japanese generally did not hate America before the war. Now, you've got the more specialized knowledge here, Joseph, but my impression is that at least the first part of that comment, that the Japanese population was not radicalized under an extremist religion, that doesn't seem to be quite right to me. Like, my understanding is that Shintoism was the religion in effect that was radicalizing the population. Is there anything you can say to that?
Yeah. I think this is where there are some really interesting parallels to the particular conflict. And now, I've spoken to people who lived in Japan, and there are certainly cultural differences. I don't want to make it seem like, you know, Japan at this time was culturally identical to Islamic culture. But there are people who describe Japan's imperial conquest at the time as a holy war. Shintoism is a religion. Japanese culture at the time was militaristic, and there was a religious element, and there certainly was indoctrination. You'll see when we get to what America had to do in the occupation, but part of it was undo that indoctrination. So in schools, you were indoctrinated from a very young age into Shintoism, into seeing the emperor as a literal god, as a deity, at being subservient to the state. So, you know, I don't know Japanese culture enough to say that, like, exactly how similar they are, but I think it would be a mistake to say that we're dealing with completely different contexts. There are some overlaps, and in particular, there are some the religious overlaps and collectivist overlaps that are worth keeping in mind here.
Certainly. And my knowledge isn't too deep, but the way in which they seem to have been able to motivate soldiers to commit suicide attacks, in effect, and perhaps maybe you could tell me if there was a praising of martyrdom, in effect, something similar, that would seem to be something where there's a parallel as well, in the way in which, to get a population to engage in that kind of thing, you have to have really radicalized them for a long time and in a deep way, I would think.
Oh, certainly. And, you know, one of my favorite books growing up was a book called Shogun. They've actually just turned it into a show that's quite excellent. It's another recommendation. But you learn even that's about more Imperial Japan back in, I think, 1400s or Middle Ages. And, you know, honor is this important part of their culture. I mean, you would rather commit suicide than bring dishonor to your family or to your name. I think it's called seppuku when you do that. And so, yeah, that's an excellent parallel to draw. Just think about the kind of culture you have to live in where you would martyr yourself. And you know, the stories of Japanese kamikaze pilots are well documented, that they would do that towards the end of the war for the mother country. So, you know, it's well documented in Islam, the suicide bombers and how they take their extremism.
Certainly. And although, you know, I don't have the knowledge to make a direct comparison between what the Japanese education system was like and the education system in Gaza and in the West Bank, certainly some of the stuff we've seen reported about what has been being taught in the textbooks in UNRWA schools very much is praising that kind of giving your life for martyrs. Martyrs are is almost like the moral ideal. So
And maybe towards the end, if we have some time, we can talk about some of the I think there are certainly a lot of overlaps. I think hopefully we made the case that it's not an irrelevant comparison. We can touch on at the end, though, some things that are different. I've done a bit of digging on how do they differ and why might this comparison be problematic? Why might it not be as easy to affect the same sort of change? But maybe we can dive into the next part, which is what actually happened in the occupation? How did this actually come about? And what are specific things that America did? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the first most important things was the utter and total defeat of Japan and the almost perceptual level that this had to happen. And I want to share one example. And again, I think we're not going to cover everything in the 30 minutes that we have today. So I do recommend reading the book, but I want to give you just a sense of the concrete nature of, or a concrete sense of the nature of this occupation. So I want you to imagine this scenario, right? So Japan just had two nuclear bombs dropped on them, atomic bombs. They're ready to surrender. Here is how the surrender happened, just to paint a picture at the visceral perceptual nature of the defeat of Japan. America puts over 100 warships, battleships, destroyers in Tokyo Bay, right? So they flood Tokyo Bay with American ships, gleaming ships, all their guns, etc. I think all the sailors on the decks. They make the Japanese contingent board MacArthur's ship, right? So Japan has to come to MacArthur's ship to sign the declaration of surrender. So Tokyo Harbor, if you're sitting on shore and you see this insanely large naval force in your bay, guns essentially pointed at your shores. And then America sends about 400 B-29 super fortresses. These are the big boys that were pounding Japan, firebombing Tokyo. 400 fly over, essentially blacking out the sky. Right. And that's the context in which the surrender happens, right? That's visceral. That's perceptual. Your defeat is clear. And on top of that, you then have shortly after 250,000 well-fed strapping, confident GIs land on your shores, right? America put 250,000 soldiers into Japan right after the declaration of surrender. And it's not like, it's not these like war-torn, defeated soldiers. You know, Japan's on the brink of starvation. So you've got these people who are being well-fed from an industrialized country that's successful, that just destroyed your army and got you to surrender, landing on your shores. The defeat and occupation was total from that perspective. And I just want to contrast that with what I read in Ilan Chernow's book, No Substitute for Victory. Or sorry, this is What Justice Demands. He talks about how Israel occupied after the Six-Day War. And Israel made a point of not having a military presence in Palestinian communities. They made their bases away from the Palestinian villages. They did not want their presence to be felt. They did not want the Palestinians to feel like a defeated people. And so I want to contrast that and keeping that in mind in the context, because it's not like what we're about to discuss with the occupation happens in a vacuum. It happens in this very, very visceral state of defeat where you lost. So I think that's a really important point to make.
For sure. And so so the defeat was total, and there was no idea in their mind that they were going to continue. So then the Americans come in and essentially, I guess, embark on, well, an occupation, but an effort to re-educate or reprogram the population.
Yeah, I'll read you another quote that just outlines the scale of what America is going to attempt to do. So the quote is, America set about doing what no other occupation force had done before, remaking the political, social, cultural, and economic fabric of a defeated nation, and in the process, changing the very way of thinking of the populace. So again, we've got this backdrop that Japan is culturally very militaristic, religious, that this is a holy war. They're being indoctrinated. And you think about the scale of what America has to do. And here, I think, is a great opportunity to dive into some examples concretely. There's a lot more that I could cover, but I think it's important to think about what does it actually mean at a detailed level to occupy and remake a political, social, and cultural fabric. So from a high level, you know, it's doing things like removing and purging all of the home ministry and national police forces. So all those people that you get in a dictatorship who, you know, like the SS equivalent of Nazi, like the people who enforce this military totalitarian, they're gone. They're out. I don't know if they're in jail or what, but they're removed from a position of power. So there's no more, you know, police force keeping the people in check kind of thing. From a totalitarian perspective, not from a liberty perspective. They impose a constitution. So America writes the constitution. It goes into depth in the book, where they kind of gave the Japanese a chance to create their own constitution, but America had final say. America rewrote large portions of it. You know, things that went into it are women now had rights. You have civil liberties. You have even restructuring of the separation of powers, right, between the parliament and other bodies within the government. So an imposed democratic system on Japan and a liberal system. You also get things, I want to get a bit more detailed and specific because there are some really great tidbits in this book. You get things like Japan had a very kind of almost feudal land ownership system where it was government imposed monopolies, you know, almost like oligarchical. Very few people owned a lot of the agriculture land. They broke up those monopolies, right? So you weren't allowed to have a government imposed monopoly on land ownership. So you're talking about really doing things that are consistent with a liberal style society. Another anecdote that I just want to share that really struck me at the level of detail you get to, and I think it's particularly relevant for the current situation in Israel, is they had a cultural shift in how marriage was thought about. And this was a combination of just the American presence, right? A lot of the GIs brought their wives. And so you just got American culture around you. But marriage prior to the occupation was a very, you know, dutiful interaction or contract between man and wife. Like, it was not this partnership of equals. An example they talk about in the book is this shift from marriage as a duty or subservient of woman to man to this basis of a relationship on love. And even the idea of sexual gratification, right? That sex is meant not as a duty in a relationship, but as something to be enjoyed by partners, started to become a shift in the culture, right? So I think it's important to understand that you can't just impose, you know, a new constitution, right? You just go in there and MacArthur says, thou shalt have democracy, and that you're going to have this change. The very nature of how the Japanese started thinking about marriage and sex had to change as well. Now, this is me reading into it a little bit. I'll say, like, that was just something that I took out from it, but seems relevant in how I've heard some intellectuals talk about it, is that it's like, if you think about George Bush going into Iraq, and he essentially said, thou shalt have democracy, and look at the failure that is, right? You cannot start with politics. You have to make it a complete and total change. One other, just two other quick points about concrete things that were done that I think are instructive. America had final say on all textbooks in schools. So they were in charge of curriculum, essentially. They got to approve or reject any textbook. So anything glorifying the emperor, treating him as a deity, anything glorifying militarism or that militaristic nation or holy war, out. America got to impose a liberal style education onto Japan. And there's a direct parallel with what UNRWA's been doing and in the Palestinian communities and the kind of education they're getting. And the last thing I'll just mention is, America was a benevolent occupier. I think the way occupation is often talked about these days, especially in the context of Israel, is it's this necessarily evil act, right? That when you're occupying, you're going to create radicalization. That Israel's actions of occupation, by not just leaving and letting them be, you're creating generations of radicalized youth that are going to come up and continue this violence. This example couldn't be, like, an occupation doesn't need to be that way. America provided food and aid. They helped rebuild Japan, right? Japan was on the brink of starvation and collapse at the end of the war. America came in and was viewed as a savior by a lot of the people. A lot of the individual civilians welcomed them, right, as, you know, these successful and, you know, benefactors. So an occupation doesn't necessarily need to be bad. And in the American case, how many Japanese suicide bombers do we hear about today bombing American institutions? We just don't hear about it. So you can do an occupation properly in such a way that does not lead to a resentful population, and that can lead to lasting success. So sorry, I went on for a lot, but I really wanted to get those concrete details out.
No, that was good. I mean, the point about marriage as well, you know, it is concrete, but I think that's a fascinating insight. And it seems like, as you say, the change was brought about at a deep level in the sense of cultural values. And, you know, maybe just quickly, maybe in a sense you partly answered this, but was there any kind of resistance from the population? Maybe that goes to the total defeat, but my expectation would be there would be a kind of ultra conservative faction that would say, we're not going to do this.
Certainly. And in particular, it came from the elites, which I don't think would be surprising. So the people in power who were least affected by the war, right, who still, you know, got access to food supplies and, you know, the corrupt politicians and a lot of the conservatives were very much opposed to it. There was pushback against it. There were people that tried to fight against it. Certainly they had no choice, right? They didn't ultimately, at the end of the day, have any other choice around it. And there's certainly a lot of, you know, there were also a lot of Japanese who were really happy about this. Anecdotally, I was speaking with somebody recently whose mother married a GI. And I was asking him, you know, what did she think about this, like, end of World War II? And she was just ecstatic. Like, when she saw her first GI, she was over the moon. Like, they were starving in the, like, you have to remember that as indoctrinated as they were, Japan was not this super prosperous place by the end of the war. They're starving. They're getting ready for a land invasion. They're being told to sacrifice for the country. Some of them were ecstatic about them. A lot of them were just in survival mode. But, you know, yes, there was pushback, but it was interesting. From what I read, it came mostly from the elites.
Mm-hmm. And so then we're just in the last 5 minutes. So making comparisons with Israel, What do you think we can say in comparison? And then, you know, as in to bring about a resolution. And maybe if you've seen anything Netanyahu said about his plan for the end of the war, what do you think based after reading this book?
Yeah, so maybe let's talk about I actually don't know what Netanyahu has said specifically. So maybe we can talk about that. But just briefly on where does maybe this comparison fall apart? What are some at least open questions I don't have the answers for that are worth considering? So first of all, when I spoke to somebody that had lived in Japan for many years and I asked him this question, one thing he cautioned me about was a key difference in the Japanese culture is the way they treated victors. So in Japanese culture, when you were defeated, it was part of your culture was you now became subservient to the victor. So there was already this cultural capitulation that was going to happen. As soon as it was clear that they had lost, your honor kind of transferred to now following. And I don't know if Islam has that same relationship. In fact, you know, from my reading of the history of Islam, there's a lot of you know, Islam had a golden age, right? They were on par with Europe, and now there's going to be some psychological implications where they probably feel like they should be the dominant culture in the region and are not. Another, I think, important difference that I don't know how it would play out is Japan was kind of isolated in the perspective of there's a clear enemy within a geographic region. There's a very big buffer, right, in terms of the Pacific Ocean. Israel's dealing with a situation. If you just, let's say, occupied, impose an American-style occupation on Gaza and the West Bank, let's say, and you re-educated just those regions, you still have to account for the like total surrounding area where they are all like, if you're not going to go and occupy Iran and Syria and Jordan and everyone around you. Or would it be successful? That I do not know. And that's the biggest question mark I have about it is I'm not sure if you could have a similar sort of success. What I do wonder about though is would you at least, if you stated the goal very clearly, that the goal is a sovereign, peaceful nation living side by side with us, and that here's the example we're going to follow, emphasize the Japan example as a desired outcome of this still preserved culture that is peaceful and an ally. I wonder if you would at least be able to engage in the kind of actions that are necessary. But the wild card is, you know, you have all of these hostile nations that are, you know, you're not, unless you're going to go occupy those places too and do the same shift, you're still going to have this opposing force acting against you.
Sure. So, final 2 minutes, I guess, key takeaways that the Americans went in with a very clear goal in mind, that the defeat of the Japanese was total and made very visceral for them, and that the program of re-education was benevolently done, but the forces of reaction in the culture weren't given any choice, that this was very forthrightly and decisively put into place, in effect. But
Definitely. And just one last note of optimism, right? There are what is it? 20% of Israel is not Jewish, right? And you know, I know polls have recently, since October 7th, they're more in favor of Israel than they were before, but living quite peacefully within Israel. So that gives me optimism that an occupation done right in the West Bank and Gaza to pacify and create sovereign states for them would work, right? That, you know, just like the 20% of Israelis, once they've lived in this prosperous and Israel, I was born in Israel, I've been to Israel many times. It is this amazing place. And so if you live through that, if the Palestinians have an opportunity to have a better education, right, that where they're not indoctrinated, I am somewhat optimistic that there is an ability to be resilient to those outside forces. Right. Are you going to want to be as indoctrinated when you get a taste of what a Western civilization can look like and be like?
Absolutely. Well, we're going to have to wrap up because the reality show is starting in just 60 seconds. But thank you so much, Joseph. This was fascinating. If you guys enjoy it, make sure you say in the comments, and maybe we can get Joseph back if he's got some time in his busy schedule. Thank you so much to the super chatters. Sorry we focused on the meat of the conversation for it, but thank you, Catherine, Marilyn, Bonnie, Gail, and Jonathan. And I hope you guys will come over to the reality show. We're talking about the aid situation in Gaza, so somewhat connected to what we were kind of talking about just now. Thank you so much, Joseph, and we'll see you all in just a minute.
Thank you so much.
Bye bye.